The number one priority is getting people back to work and getting the economy growing. I think the jobs report today is another sign that we're doing that, but we got a long way.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Jacob Goldstein.
And I'm Adam Davidson. Today is Friday, January 7th. That was White House Economic Advisor Austin Goolsbee. You heard at the top. You know, he went to college with our very own David Kestenbaum. On the show today, we tell you what to worry about in 2011. But first, often the cause of worry, our own Planet Money indicator. Jacob, what do you have for us?
Adam, for you today, I have 1.1 million. That number is how many jobs the American economy added in 2010. It may sound like a lot, but remember, 8 million jobs disappeared during the recession. And really, over the course of a whole year, a million jobs just isn't that many. It isn't enough.
Right. We didn't get that burst upwards that you normally want to see after a recession.
Right. I mean, like a million over the course of the year. It's one thing if it's like, you know, negative or slow at the beginning of the year and then better, better, better. You can say, okay, it wasn't a great year, but it's promising. We feel the strength building. We do not feel that now.
But we did see that there was lower unemployment, only 9.4%. I'm saying only as if
that's great news.
Yeah. That's still pretty lousy. But it is better than the previous month of 9.8%.
Right? You could say it's less bad. But you know, there is this really important caveat when we're thinking about unemployment, and especially now, which is this: only people who are out of work and looking for a job count toward the unemployment rate. And when you dig into these numbers, it looks like part of the drop that we just saw in the unemployment rate, it actually came because people just gave up on finding a job.
They just pulled themselves out of the labor force.
Right. So essentially, a lower percentage of Americans of working age are either working or trying to find a job. And that's really bad. I mean, you want Americans, you know, who are of working age and healthy, you want them to be either working or looking for a job.
Right. All right. So now we have the final jobs numbers. Let's put 2010 to bed. I feel I'm over 2010.
Enough already with 2010. That's it. I'm done with 2010.
Right. And
maybe until GDP comes out. But for today, let's be done with 2010.
Let's be done with 2010. Let's move on to 2011. And
who can believe it?
Who can believe it? So there's this group of people. Their offices happen to be right across the street. And I love going there. It's Eurasia Group. They're a consulting group, like big governments and big companies hire them to find out what's going on in the world. What should I be worried about? How are different political things going to affect me? And it's just really fun to go over there. It's just this big floor filled with super wonky, really bright young people who are constantly studying their little area. Like they know everything about the Kazakhstan oil industry.
Right. And it's great. I mean, I get emails. You probably get emails from them too, right? And it's some email about like what the shift in the Polish legislature means for you. And it's like, what Polish legislature? What, you know, but they know everything about everything.
Exactly. And then once a year, end of December and into January, they take these dozens and dozens and dozens of analysts and they sift through the world's data, and the big thinkers get together and decide, all right, what do all these discrete, what does the Polish legislature and this new Kazakh oil law and all this stuff add up to? What are the big risks facing the world in 2011? So I talked to the guy who ran this operation of figuring out what's going on in the world. It's David Gordon. He's the head of research at Eurasia Group. He came from the State Department, where he was a high-level official there. And he started the conversation by bringing us something that we don't get to bring our listeners all that often, some good news about the global economy.
This year, we share a general optimism that, you know, the world economy is in better shape now. You know, the U.S., we're more optimistic about. The emerging markets continue to do pretty well. But there's this underlying thing going on there that people are uncomfortable about. And we tried to get more insight into it and to figure out what it was. And that's what led us to our top risk this year, which is this thing, this new world system.
So let's get into this. You call it G0. And for many years, we heard about the G7,
right,
which is the 7 richest countries
in the
world.
That's right.
And then we heard about the G8.
When we added Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Right. And then there was sort of the G8 plus one, which was China was sort of showing up for meetings, not taking a serious role. And that was a world in which there was a global economy that really – we did the podcast a few weeks ago about the Plaza Accords. I mean, really could have – 7 or 8 guys, mostly guys, sit in a room and sort of make the
work
big decisions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
And then,
that lasted for a pretty long time, and it worked.
It kept the global economy reasonably stable.
Yeah.
Major issues were dealt with.
Right.
It was a period of more global trade, fewer tariffs, fewer big trade wars. Mm-hmm. All right. So last year, we heard a lot about the G20 that we added a whole bunch of countries that not that long ago were sort of irrelevant, tiny basket case economies, but had become really important.
That's right.
China became a much fuller player. Yeah. India, Brazil.
Indonesia, Turkey. That's right. Saudi.
Right. So we had an interview with Mohamed El Arian at PIMCO who explained to us, we are moving to a much safer world. We're moving to a multipolar world where instead of having, you want to say instead of 3 legs to the stool, there'll be 4, but it's instead of having 7 or 8 legs to the stool, there'll be 20. But as he said, in 20 years, we'll have that world, but there's a lot of chaos in between. So you're actually saying that the big risk here is something called the G0.
Right. And the G0 is this interim world, because I think that Al Arian is probably right in the long term. But
you mean 20 years from now, having lots and lots of sources
of
power, that's
a
better world than one superpower and lots of people want to.
That's right.
Yeah.
But in the short term, that we're heading to a world that's much messier, because what's happened now is the G20 sort of worked in the first phase of the financial crisis. Worked quite well. But then it sort of stopped working. And as we began to come out of the financial crisis, there was less and less agreement. And then this fall, I think with the IMF meeting here in the United States in Washington and the Seoul G20 meeting, it really became clear that there was no basis for any real joint action on rebalancing the global economy, restructuring the global financial system, and that the momentum has really run out on the G20, at least for now. And what the G0 is, it recognizes...
Now, this is a phrase you've made up. It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
Right.
It's a concept.
Right.
It's a concept. But basically what it is in a context in which the United States reputationally has been weakened by the financial crisis, blamed for it, and our model particularly of capital markets and all of this is now no longer seen as things that countries should aspire to. So that reputational hit combined with our own relatively weak recovery and fiscal challenges.
Our deficit.
Our deficit, exactly.
And our massive debt.
Yeah, means that we aren't giving the kind of leadership to the world economy that we did forever. If you look at Europe and Japan, they're in, if anything, much worse shape than the United States. I mean, Europe is totally consumed by this internal crisis that in the past, frankly, the United States would have been more actively involved in helping to resolve. But the part of the G0 world is that we don't do that now.
We focus on our needs.
Right.
They focus on their needs.
Exactly.
China focuses on their needs.
China and India are coming up. They're playing not insignificant roles, particularly China's a huge player. But they're all marked by this dichotomy of being growing players but still being very poor countries, completely focused on their own needs of their citizenry. Not surprisingly, right? So right now the G0 is a world in which there's much less international leadership. Nobody's willing or capable of taking on the leadership role. And as a result of the lack of leadership, you don't get the kind of cooperation and agreement on global rebalancing, on Doha and trade relations, on how to handle currency appreciation in the developing countries.
And I just want to go in and define those a little bit. So,
sure.
So global rebalancing, this is an obsession among global financial experts. We have some countries, Germany and China spring to mind, that have They basically are large surpluses. They're selling much more to the rest of the world than they're buying.
That's exactly right.
And then you have other countries, most notably the U.S., right. with huge and long-term deficits
right.
where we're buying more from the rest right. of the world than we're selling. And the reason this makes people nervous is that that kind of imbalance where money is sort of piling up in one country and another country is getting deeper and deeper into debt, it actually can create massive havoc. And I think
that's right. And this was one of the main sources of the financial crisis.
Exactly. When you hear this whole idea that, China lent us lots of money to buy cheap houses, that's a side effect. Of this surplus
yes.
issue. And
yes.
Actually, one reason I think that I was very, very slow to understand the importance of subprime housing in the U.S. as the proximate cause of a crisis is I was so focused on this China-U.S.
Right. That's right.
As were many other people.
Yes. Yeah. 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 So this is one of the main causes of crisis, and this is what we and everybody else in the world economy hopes to rebalance. Now, rebalancing is going on. Markets are driving it a bit, but it's not going on in a coordinated way. And in particular, the large current account surplus countries are not being responsive to the current account deficit countries, with the most important player here being China. And this is where the China exchange rate issues comes into play.
In a normal world, if you really have a free-floating currency right. exchange rate,
right.
if China has way too much cash
right.
and the U.S. has too little,
right.
that eventually market forces will just adjust the exchange rate.
That's right.
Things in China will be more expensive. Yeah. Things in the U.S. will be cheaper. Yeah. And eventually we should even out.
That's right. The Chinese yuan should be appreciating and should have been appreciating for years. And it's one thing for when China was a small player in the world economy, even though it had a lot of people, it didn't matter all that much. But now they're the second largest economy in the world. They're on their way to becoming the world's leading trading partner, and that they still hold to an economic model basically in which exports are growing at twice the rate of economic growth. And it just doesn't work anymore because other people aren't going to like it or allow it. And that's a big part of the problem of the G0 is you can't come to an agreement on this in the G20 or in the IMF as we saw last fall.
I mean, I got to say what I'm picturing. I remember in kindergarten, I had a very nice but very stern kindergarten teacher
yes.
who really kept order in the room. And I have this memory of when she would leave the room and all us kids would just go insane.
Go wild.
And yeah. sometimes we'd all beat up on the same kid. And that's sort of the world I'm picturing, that I think the U.S. in its own conception was the kindergarten teacher yes. keeping the rest of the world in line for a long time.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I think a lot of what the emerging markets are doing, frankly, I think makes complete sense from their interests. That we look at China and we see the second largest economy in the world and this overemphasis on exports and big current account surpluses. The Chinese see a country that's ranked maybe 90th or 95th in per capita income, this huge flow of people coming in from the countrysides into the cities, and their view is that they just have to run to keep that from causing complete chaos.
Right. Right. And that's what strikes you when you go to China. You think of China as just this unbelievable monster that's
right.
going to eat up the
right.
U.S. Right. And you go there and they're like, oh my God, this thing might fall apart any day now.
Exactly.
So I'm remembering I once interviewed a former finance minister of India early on in the financial crisis, and he just had this smile on his face, and he was talking about how the U.S. officials used to show up
exactly and say, "You got to do this.
You got to. We know how to run a
right.
modern economic yeah, system.
Absolutely.
You idiots don't know anything."
Right.
And just the joy on his face,
yes.
and everything they did that was wrong, like not opening themselves up to global financial markets, turned out to be, at least in the short term, pretty smart.
Not wrong.
Yeah.
No, that's exactly. And that's the problem. That's the source of this decline of U.S. power and influence.
But we still have the Navy that controls the world seas.
Our military
is bigger than all other militaries combined.
This is not a statement about security, but it is a statement about a world that is becoming ever more driven by economic themes, right? That the big issues now in the world, a larger proportion of them are economic than ever before.
All right. So in this new world where the kindergarten teacher has left,
right.
Where all the kids the are running around.
The kindergarten teacher has left the building.
Has left the building. Or the kindergarten teacher has become one of the kids, I guess, is what we're really saying. That the U.S. is.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's right.
Is focused on its own political issues. Yeah. So let's go through some of the other top risks. So your number two risk, and does that mean it's the number two most dangerous or the number two most likely?
I think it's a combination of dangerous and likely.
Okay. So number two should be very familiar to Planet Money listeners because it's something we've done a lot on is Europe. Yeah.
And the Europe risk is quite simple, that the Europeans aren't going to come up with an effective strategy to manage the financial crisis. The strategy that they've undertaken is what we call bailouts with conditionality. And you know, so far it's – It's not working perfectly, but it's kept putting Band-Aids on these issues.
On Greece, on
that's
Ireland.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Saying to Greece, okay, we're going to bail you out, but you've got to stop paying your workers much money and giving them so much overtime. And
our concern is that what you see in Europe now isn't what you get by the end of the year. That basically austerity is going to be very hard to sustain in peripheral Europe, in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, in Ireland, that even more so, these countries aren't going to rapidly move to reform their basic government services, to reform their labor markets and their rules. All of the conditions that they're supposed to agree to under these bailout programs, they're not going to implement because they're politically infeasible, especially when the growth prospects for those countries over the next year or two look very, very weak. Right. So, but they're not going to drop out of the eurozone either. They're basically going to do what a lot of emerging markets used to do when they were dependent on the IMF and the World Bank for their funding. They used to sign these agreements and then do some of the stuff and then not do the others and sort of throw it back on the IMF and the World Bank. This is going to be thrown back on Germany, back on the ECB, back on the European Union.
The European Central Bank, the ECB. Yeah.
And the problem here is that's going to feed this political push, especially in Germany, to say, wait a second, why are we continuing to bail out these guys even as they don't do what they claim they were going to do? And so that's going to play back and feed this movement in Germany on opposition to this. And then markets are going to see this happening, and they're going to push up interest rates. And the problem is when this hits big countries like Italy and Spain, and they can't finance their bond issuances except at exorbitant rates, they come into crisis, and then that throws a much bigger issue back on the ECB and the European Union. So we don't think that 2011 is the year when really push comes to shove about the future of the eurozone, but we set up that this year for possibly 2012 or 2013 to be really tough years.
Right, and we have a bunch more risks to get through, so let's go through these. The third top risk, it was the one that surprised me the most. I certainly wasn't thinking about it at all. Cybersecurity and geopolitics.
Yeah,
so it's, you're talking about like Chinese hackers bringing down the U.S. Defense Department?
It's a bunch of different things here. It's basically technologically driven both on the vulnerability side and on the capability side. So on the vulnerability side, it's the increasing integration of all sorts of systems in the world, especially systems related to critical infrastructure. And that centralization means that in many ways these systems are much less vulnerable to natural disasters. But you've had on the offense side this increasing capability to get inside things. So it's the rise of integrated system that creates the risk. It's also the limited capacity of what military force can get you, and for not just for the United States, but for everybody.
I mean, we saw that with the WikiLeaks.
Absolutely. That's right.
One guy with a shadowy group of assistants could really wreak havoc to the U.S. diplomatic and military mission around the world.
And Assange is going to go down this year, one way or the other. And I think in many ways that's a good thing. But the bad news is that there's a whole cohort of what I call info-anarchists who are out there who may be radicalized by that and just go to attack all sorts of things. It happened a little bit in the few days after Assange was arrested a couple of weeks ago.
Right. We had all these major websites taken down, major companies.
Yeah. So,
by kids doing simple stuff.
So I think this is – we talk about this world, cybersecurity and geopolitics, as being a big known unknown, that we know that this is an area where you have these growing vulnerabilities, growing capabilities, and lots of incentives. But, you know, there's just not enough – structure around any of this to be able to predict exactly where any of this is going to go.
So let's kind of whip through because I don't think we have time to go through everything in depth.
Yeah. So the fourth risk is China. The fifth risk is North Korea. And that's really the most dangerous sort of traditional geopolitical risk.
And I got to say, actually, personally, like this is the first one that kind of scares me. I mean, mostly you've been talking about financial
That's
stuff.
Right.
Now we're talking about like nuclear power, rogue
this
nations.
This is a scary one, and it's made scarier by the fact that North Korea is this hermit state, and we don't really know what's going on there. So this risk could play out in two quite different ways. Way number one is that the North Koreans are going through this transition, this leadership transition. They see that China is basically being very, very careful with them because China wants to have as much influence as they can in the post-transition period. And this gives them a mistaken view that they really can go about and be much more aggressive vis-a-vis South Korea and maybe even U.S. facilities, military facilities in South Korea, and that you get something very big happening out of that. That would be very dangerous.
Way bigger than just shooting some bombs at an island somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's risk number one. Risk number two is that it plays out on the other side, that North Korea, which we have reason to believe is really not doing very well at all economically, the food needs are great, but that the political transition fails and things really begin to fall apart in North Korea. In those circumstances, China will want to go in to keep order because their big worry is that you have millions and millions of North Koreans crossing the border into China.
So China invading and sort of taking over North Korea? That really is a possibility.
Oh, yes. It's a restoration of order. It would be to restore order and to put in place something new. But meanwhile, in that circumstances, U.S. and South Korean forces would cross and move north to secure the nuclear facilities. The problem is that the U.S. and China have never sat down and say, okay, this scenario, worst case, it's out there. We don't really have conflicting interests here. How are we going to avoid getting into each other's grills, right? And that's never happened.
Wow. Now, on this list of 10, I just want to point out some that aren't there. There's no, like, Al-Qaeda-like terrorism attack. There's no terrorism at all, really, except Pakistan maybe doing stuff.
Pakistan is put at risk by terrorism. So we have – it's very, very hard to systemically make a judgment about is the U.S. going to get attacked? Is Europe going to get attacked? We don't know anything more than what most citizens know and what we're hearing from the government. So it's hard for us to put this down in a meaningful way. Pakistan is going to be put at risk by a combination of very bad governance plus extremism that's only really widespread in the north but is seeping down. That's a big deal. We're quite concerned about Pakistan.
Okay. Now, you started this conversation by saying I mean, the first few sentences were actually pretty optimistic that the economy is going to pull out.
Yeah.
And then you just scared the hell out of all of
us. Well, I'm not, but these are, I think that we are, in some structural sense, we are in a period of the beginnings of a better global recovery and global healing. But all of the things we talked about are still there. So I can't get overly optimistic about where we're going because of all of these challenges.
We'll have a link to Eurasia Group's top risks report on our blog. There's some risks we didn't get into.
I can't wait.
They're at npr.org/money.
Also on the blog, we have more on the jobs numbers, including this great video our production assistant Jess Jiang put together that shows how the jobs picture changed over the past decade. You can also email us, as always, at planetmoney@npr.org.
Before we leave, I want to say a personal thank you to Ellen Weiss, Senior Vice President of News for NPR, resigned yesterday. And I just think you all should know that without Ellen Weiss, there would be absolutely no Planet Money. I mean, frankly, there wouldn't be a lot of great things at NPR. She really was responsible for so much that any NPR fan loves about NPR. But especially for us, she is responsible for Planet Money. It was her idea for Alex and I to work together on the Giant Pool of Money. It was her idea to take what we learned from the Giant Pool of Money and create a sustainable, ongoing project, Planet Money. It was her incredible internal support that allowed Planet Money to grow and to thrive. She's been a really good friend to us personally. She's been an incredible leader and supporter. Without Ellen Weiss, there would absolutely be no Planet Money. NPR would be a much poorer place overall. We are really sad that we're not going to be working with her in the near future, although we certainly hope we'll have a chance to work with her again. We love you, Ellen. We're really going to miss you, and we'll certainly stay in touch. So thank you for everything, Ellen. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Jacob Goldstein. Thanks for listening.